Everybody, welcome back to P3, the PFOS Pulse podcast, the companion podcast to HRP subscription service, the PFOS Pulse. If you're not subscribed already, do so. Go to hrpassociates.com/PFOS. Get subscribed today. But today, I, Tom Simmons, host of P3, am joined by Lisa Alieco and Robert Simmons in our HRP Connecticut office. Can the two of you introduce yourselves real quickly, starting with Bob?
Hey, Bob Simmons. I am the chief hydrogeologist here at HRP. 35 years in the company, and going to talk a little bit about hopefully some of the new expectations that the Connecticut DEP has put out with regards to primarily PFOS, but also some of the other emerging contaminants.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alieco, project manager here in the Farmington, Connecticut office. I work on the geology side of things in the environmental industry for remediation and site investigation.
We're here today, as Bob indicated, to talk about some PFOS regulations as it pertains to Connecticut. We're in Connecticut here. It's Farmington, Connecticut. It is HRP's headquarters. It is where HRP started, but it will just be one of the states we'll be touching on in our series here, where we look at how PFOS regulation affects the states in which HRP is located. So, Bob, what is new with PFOS in Connecticut?
Well, a number of things came out, I believe, like towards the end of March. A few of the standard forms that we submit when properties are entering the or not entering the Connecticut Property Transfer Program, which is a state-specific program that we have here for sites that operated as either as hazardous waste generators or certain categories of high-risk operations. So when you're entering into the Connecticut program, Property Transfer Program, you file a series of forms about which give you a sense or gives the DEP a sense of the condition of the property and whether or not there'll need to be additional investigation or remediation. Accompanying that form is a thing called the Environmental Condition Assessment Form, or ECAF. There we go with the acronyms. We'll start rolling soon. And that ECAF basically gives a snapshot of the understanding of the environmental conditions. So depending where you are in the investigation and or remediation of the property, you know, you can give the DEP kind of a pretty good rundown of, you know, what the potential receptors are in the area, what the history of the site was in general from an industrial standpoint, what contaminants are present at the site and in the environment due to historical operations. One of the new pages that was added into the ECAF form in March of this year was an entire page about emerging contaminants, PFOS being, you know, primary among them, but also any other emerging contaminants now that come along. There's also concern in there expressed about 1,4-dioxane, which is a preservative that was added to a lot of the chlorinated salts. And that page basically is a checklist. If your site has ever had these kind of operations or used these kind of materials, you know, you may need to evaluate for PFOS contamination.
One of the things that surprised me, and I don't know if it surprised you, was the various operations that were listed on that checklist. Did you find some of those surprising as well?
The checklist is almost anything that has ever happened anytime, anywhere. Yeah, it's very comprehensive. I mean, it does give you, in fact, now a pretty good guide of what the expectations of the DEP are going to be, which is good because, yes, for the many years now, PFOS has been kind of sitting there but not well-defined. You know, did you have to address it? You know, well, finally, we realize, yes, we do. And then how do you address it? And then what is that expectation that the DEP is going to have of how hard you've looked to indicate whether or not you really should have been testing or should be testing for PFOS in your site investigation?
Is pesticides listed on that list?
Yeah, it is in there, actually. Now, certain pesticide uses, you know, are suspect for PFAS, along with car washes and some other things you probably weren't thinking of before.
I had heard about the car washes because of the waxes, right?
Yep.
Yep.
Now, why was pesticides an interesting addition to that list, do you think?
I did not assume or think that pesticides had PFAS in it as an ingredient.
Yeah.
Which I've done a little bit more research on recently, and I've read that there are some pesticides that are manufactured with PFAS, but there's also the containers that the pesticides are stored in are apparently leaching the PFAS into the pesticides, and then the pesticides are being applied to properties.
Yeah, I think the active reason for putting the PFAS into the certain pesticide herbicide mixtures is for those properties of wetting and getting the material to move, you know, more across the applied surfaces and stuff. So, as well as the containers, which are problematic.
Yeah, I was also reading it was to help the sprayability of the pesticides that the PFAS were being added for that reason.
They're a wonderful material, you know, for their industrial property, but unfortunately, they're aptly named the forever chemicals, as I'm sure you've talked about many times here on P3.
Yeah. Now, oftentimes we talk about regulations or standards, and they're in a kind of suggested sort of phase where there's still a long way to go before they kind of become the hard and fast rules by which our jobs are determined. Often we're looking at something at the federal level that has to go through public comment period. Are the things that we're talking about today relevant to Connecticut, are these now the hard and fast rules that are going to determine how we move forward, or is there still some bureaucratic process through which these can disappear?
They're not going to be going away. The process is still in flux, as it is throughout the country. We do now have some guidance where it's a sum of several of the PFAS compounds have to stay below that 70 part per trillion level. They've given us a directive or a guidance to which analytical methods to use. Most of the analytical to date that we've been doing has been on an EPA method, 537. There's a newer one called the 1663. And one of the things that that has is a broader list. I think it expands from about 13 components to about 40. So we'll be seeing more potential PFAS that we weren't looking for necessarily with the old analytical method. Again, analytical methods are evolving as is the cleanup standards that we have to face. For our clients.
How do these changes affect our clients, or will they? Or how do you think they will affect our clients going forward?
Up until fairly recently, whether or not you looked at PFAS was kind of a client choice to some degree. That's pretty much for Connecticut now, I think, gone by the wayside.
Yeah,
that may still happen for some types of evaluations, like, you know, if it's a simple commercial transaction, like for a bank or something like that, that are looking at, you know, non-residential property but non-industrial, it probably won't raise its head. But, you know, pretty much any time now that we're looking at any property that has had industrial activity on it, we'll have to do some level of PFAS evaluation. And in some cases, fairly significant, including right at the very inception with the what we call the phase one environmental site assessment.
Do you anticipate the rates for those phase ones going up for consulting firms in the state as a result of this?
I don't know that we have looked at that as yet. I think it's... we do, as part of the phase one process, you give a questionnaire that is essentially verbatim out of the ASTM, American Society for Testing and Materials.
Yes.
Standard.
Uh-huh.
I think we will be adapting a PFAS questionnaire that we had been developing for some of our very conservative clients, I'll say,
mm-hmm.
who wanted us, have been wanting us to look at PFAS for a few years now, and try to adapt that into something that is probably as comprehensive as what we're seeing here in the environmental condition assessment form.
Mm.
Along those lines, I was also curious if the analytical testing for the 40 chemicals now, is that more expensive than the list for the 13?
That I haven't looked at the pricing on those myself. My guess is, like anything, it's not going to get cheaper.
Right, and yeah. It's already expensive. It's already expensive analytical tests to begin with.
Compared to the routine things that we run on a day-to-day basis. One of the problems with that is because the materials are so ubiquitous in the built environment, the PFAS, and because mm-hmm. the regulatory levels are in the part per trillion, there's specific sampling protocols, and we're going to have specific clean room almost areas in the laboratories themselves. So it's very difficult for the labs to run these. And it's challenging for environmental sampling to be done in such a way that, you can avoid the cross-contamination because mm-hmm. the PFAS are they're everywhere in yep. everything.
So. Mm. Yep. And we're getting into the season of suntan lotion.
Yeah. So. Do you expect this to result in a lot of backup at labs?
Potentially for just the PFAS analysis. Okay. I have previously had investigations where the analytical data is held up just on the PFAS results because it takes a long time for them to turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're expanding the capabilities of labs in the area so they can do more PFAS testing. But yeah. initially we had to send them, cross country to get these samples analyzed.
Yeah. Like when any newer contaminant group comes into play or even a media, I envision we're going to see something akin to the real growth in, vapor and indoor air testing
mm-hmm.
that started probably 15 or so years ago, where there were only a few labs that could do it. There's only even fewer labs that could do it well and turn it around in both a meaningful way and a cost-effective way. But now there's plenty of labs that have expanded their services and even created separate almost divisions within the lab to handle all the air work that they get.
Mm-hmm.
So I envision kind of the same thing will happen with the PFAS, and it will probably make sense for certain laboratories to potentially even dedicate an entire space, because then they would know it is essentially PFAS free, if that's even a term that can be applied in reality. But yeah, just to guarantee that they're not also, inadvertently cross-contaminating samples.
Mm. So on that checklist, what were some other items on there that you thought were surprising or maybe counterintuitive to people not within the industry here, or that have a more layman's perspective like me?
I think in general, if you had looked at any one of these categories, these general categories, you would have potentially suspected a potential mm. PFAS. So I'm not so much surprised by them. The pesticide one was a new one to me when we first started looking at this. It's not something that I had considered. But I think most of them, over the last, say, 5 or 6 years since the PFAS issues have really come to the forefront, I think most of us know these types of industries. And I think what the checklist in the ECAF in particular does is present them fairly succinctly, so you can actually check off a whole category of of industrial or other types of activities. That never occurred there. That never occurred there. That never occurred there. Oh, they did do plating. Mm-hmm. And here's how I looked at, you know, the potential for the use of PFAS in the plating. Mm. So if you check on the checklist in this page, you know, any category of operation that may have been there in the past, then there's an area at the bottom of the page for, you know, more explanation. And you can say, you know, this is what, I didn't test because of this, or I did test because of this, and here's what I found. We have a number of sites where we have tested, you know, well into the investigation phase because somebody asked the question, hey, we just realized that they did, you know, operation XYZ here. That's a potential, you know, PFAS use. And we've add that into, say, the quarterly groundwater monitoring regimen, you know, for the things that we test for.
Yeah. Lisa, anything can jump out at you?
Yeah, I thought the one checklist here that says medical uses, and then it follows up with including manufacturing of medical devices, diagnostic imaging, and medical supplies and fabrics. I guess just the medical uses in and of itself, I was surprised for, because I think there's a lot of operations out there that have medical, you know, uses that don't actually make anything. They're where people come in for visits and, you know, like care. Mm. I wouldn't think that those would fall under the PFAS category, but it's kind of open-ended on this checklist. So I'm not sure if it's just the manufacturing of certain things or if it's just the generic medical use of the property. That could lead to some questions of whether facilities, you know, qualify or not.
Yeah.
Another thing that I was thinking of earlier we were talking about is the criteria for PFAS that the state has put out there right now. I know recently the Department of Public Health in the state has changed the drinking water standards to be, instead of the sum of the five PFAS, it's changed into, I think it's four individual or it's five individual criteria, and they've lowered the standards that we were previously applying to the drinking water. And I'm just thinking that down the road, they're probably going to do the same thing for groundwater and surface water and soils. And these standards are already pretty stringent and low, and bringing them down even further is just going to make it more difficult for everybody to comply with the regulations. Mm-hmm. That's a concern for our clients. Yeah.
Speaking when you talk about drinking water too, we have another overarching regulation here in Connecticut, which is the significant environmental hazard reporting requirement. So if you get certain concentrations in certain media when you're investigating a site, either in groundwater or drinking water or soil vapor, getting out into surface water, there are certain reporting requirements, and that's a whole different, you know, side program within the DEP. And one of the catches that they're pointing out, catch, not the right term here. So typically you would say, either a well, a drinking water well, has either been impacted or could be at risk, a couple of categories. Risk means that you've found contamination up gradient that could be heading towards that well and potentially impacting it. And obviously, you know, first response action on that is to sample that well, make sure it doesn't have your contaminants. But one of the ways it's written is you either have a promulgated standard, like a drinking water standard, where you can say, okay, this well is threatened because I have groundwater over that standard, either the groundwater protection criteria out of the remediation standard regulations or a drinking water standard, and that's a reportable issue. Well, there's a little caveat in there that also says that if you find something in the groundwater that's either in a well or threatening a well, and you don't have a standard for it, it may still, in fact, be reportable. And under that, PFAS, since we don't have particular standards for everything, if we find PFAS either potentially threatening a well or PFAS in a well down gradient, it would generate a significant environmental hazard reporting requirement. That's something we have to pay a little more attention to.
All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for today. So thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Folks, tune in for the PFAS segments we're going to have on our other HRP location states. This one was Connecticut. I'm sure you'll be hearing more about what's going on here soon. Remember, if you are not subscribed to the PFAS Pulse already, go to hrpassociates.com/PFAS. Subscribe today and stay safe out there, everybody. Bye.